This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Session one is called Introduction to Prostate Cancer, or Prostate Cancer 101. And it doesn't matter how many times I hear this, I'm always learning something. So it's really my pleasure to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Matthew Cooperberg, who's one of the co-leaders of the prostate cancer program in the Cancer Center, to launch us. Matt.
Good morning. So glad you all can be here with us. And good morning to everybody watching live on Zoom or who will watch this later. As you've heard, these sessions really do get a lot of subsequent viewership, which makes us all very happy because there's a lot new to say every year. Even if you've watched the previous videos, you know, this is a field that is constantly changing. And you know, with that in mind, I'm sure everyone in the room is familiar with what prostate cancer is, where the prostate is, hopefully at this point. The key thing though is really understanding which of the prostate cancers can spread, can metastasize to other parts of the body. And I find it always helpful to think about the epidemiology, the broad level view of what this cancer is doing in America and worldwide, because it really changes year to year with changes in federal policy, with how we screen and how we think about the disease. So in 2025, prostate cancer remains by far the most common cancer diagnosed among men in the US and the second leading cause of cancer death among men in the US. This number, the mortality figure in particular, has changed year over year with screening practices. And when we talk about overtreatment and overdiagnosis, and yes, there is overdiagnosis, the reason it's so important to have that conversation is because if we want to fix the mortality problem, we need to screen for the disease very aggressively. And to do that, we have to convince our colleagues in primary care that we are not going to overtreat when we find low-grade disease. So over time, the numbers have really changed. Incidence, this is the number of cancers we find every year, really reflects what primary care doctors do. Are they offering PSA testing or not, right? So when PSA started in the 1990s, we saw a huge spike in incidence. We found all these men who had been living with the disease. Things sort of stabilized in the 2000s. Then in 2012, we got this D recommendation, don't screen anybody ever, which is what the US Preventive Services Task Force said with a D recommendation. Incidence crashed to the lowest levels we've seen since the 1980s, not because cancer went away, but because we just stopped looking for it. Now the pendulum is kind of swinging back, hopefully somewhere toward the middle. We got this C recommendation in 18, which is, well, we don't really think this is a good idea, but you should have a conversation with your primary care doc about it, okay, is what the C means. In the meantime, mortality figures, now these data go back to the 30s, so it's a longer X-axis here. Since the 1990s, in the screening era, mortality has fallen for prostate cancer faster than any cancer except lung cancer, which we know we can explain because of screening practices. Because of smoking cessation, this is flattened, and we've really sort of lost this momentum. And in the meantime, we know that this is the cancer with the greatest racial disparity of any major cancer, and we've made very little progress here. We've seen comparable declines for white and black men, but really no narrowing of the gap. And if anything, rates of mortality are rising faster for black men than for anybody else. So, you know, 2012 was exactly the wrong time to stop screening for this disease. But the reason we got this recommendation was because of the variability of the cancer. And we know this is any screening for any cancer, colonoscopy, mammography, what have you. Now, the idea is you screen at intervals. If you get to the far right, you've died of the cancer. You've died of something else. If you get to the top, you've died of the cancer. And we know there are tons that we don't find with snails, even with screening. There's a lot that we can find. We can cure it, right? We can treat it. But if we never found it, it would not have caused any symptoms or threat to life. Then there's the rabbits, the ones that we can, in fact, cure with surgery, radiation therapy, other treatments before they would cause lethal disease. And then birds, you know, the ones that we cannot find because they happen so quickly, that's fortunately very uncommon in prostate cancer. And the snails are a big deal. If we look at autopsy studies, men who make it to their 70s and 80s, 50% of all men have some funny looking cells in their prostate that a pathologist would call cancer. This is not cancer the way we think about it. And this gets to this overdiagnosis issue. And the fact is we're trying really hard in 2025 not to find grade group one or Gleason 3+3. You're gonna hear a lot more about grading in a minute from Dr. Ding. But you know, grade group one prostate cancer is not cancer the way we think about it. It never ever spreads. And we're trying hard not to find it. So if you have an elevated PSA today, you should be offered an MRI or one of now seven different urine and blood tests, all of which are intended to find grade group two or higher. If the test is negative, the implication is, well, either you've got nothing or you've got grade group one. And in either of those scenarios, we don't do the biopsy. So as a urology community doing diagnosis for prostate cancer, we are explicitly, or maybe implicitly, trying not to find the grade group ones. So grade group one is not, like I said, it's not cancer the way we're all here to talk about cancer. And the reality is, this is working. So in the days of the CAPTCHA registry, which Carol started back in 1995, 50% of all the cancers we found were low risk. Grade group one, small early PSA. This has really changed over time. The right graph here is the AQUA registry, which the American Urological Association started and captures 25% of all the urologists in the country now. So in the more contemporary era, this is the 2010s and early 20s, fewer than 20% of men have low risk prostate cancer. This is a sea change. In the UK, where you basically cannot get a biopsy without having a spot visible on your MRI, this rate is about 6%. Okay, so you know, it's not to say the low risk prostate cancer is going away, but we're trying not to find it because the focus is on the high grade disease. Finding grade group one is not the point of screening. And we finally have implemented this at UCSF. So as of 2019, after a 2-year conversation with our leadership in primary care, who initially were very much kind of in lockstep with the task force, you know, medical students are all taught that PSA is a terrible test. Now, PSA is the best screening test in the history of oncology if you use it well. So we finally have baked into our primary care electronic health record system a, you know, what we consider a smarter screening initiative. So the idea is between 45 and 75, you should get a PSA test. If it's low, and for 75% of the population, it's under one, you're done. You could be done for life. We say don't check again for 5 years. But the reality is that test, if you have a PSA under one in midlife, you can pretty much write off prostate cancer for the next 25 years. There's incredibly good data to support this. If it's higher, you notice 4.0 is nowhere on this slide. So, you know, up to over 2 for younger men, 45 to 60, over 3 for older men, we think about referral, secondary testing, not biopsy, but those tests that I just mentioned, blood and urine tests and MRI. If it's intermediate, then it's certainly customized. Again, race, family history, anxiety. Some people would prefer to have the biopsy, some would not. And this is actually working. We are slowly seeing rates of screening rising at UCSF, particularly for Black men at UCSF. And we've seen this despite the COVID pandemic, which tended to, you know, really drop screening rates across the country and around the world. But the tenet here is we're recommending the screening paradigm with the assumption that basically 100% of the low-risk disease goes to active surveillance. We are not over-treating anything grade group one with surgery or radiation or focal therapy or anything else. So which ones do need treatment? We talked a lot about over-treatment. So, you know, again, the ones that are grade group one, they're low-risk. These are the turtles on that screen. These would never cause any symptoms, never threaten life, if we had not found them. And it is, you know, you all know the cliche that most men die with prostate cancer, not other. The problem again, though, is that subset are the ones that are the rabbits do still kill more men than any other cancer. Those are the ones that we need to find, the aggressive prostate cancers. This is the ones, you know, grade group three and higher. Some of the grade group twos, you're gonna hear about unfavorable histology, the ones that actually we can tell based on how they look and based on their molecular profile, which ones really need attention. And every single prostate cancer needs to be risk stratified at diagnosis. Low risk disease, like I said, we follow with active surveillance. And one of our goals here these days is to really even tone down the intensity of active surveillance for men at the lowest risk. We are doing more and more focal therapy, which we'll hear about a little bit later from Dr. Nguyen, for tumors that are group two, visible, but pretty small and early. More aggressive cancers need local therapy with surgery and radiation therapy, often with a combination of this multimodal therapy, combining treatments, maybe combining with systemic treatment as well, with hormonal therapy and other medications. And only the highest risk ones these days, only the ones that are actually significantly metastatic at diagnosis, receive systemic treatment alone. And we're making progress. This is national data, again, from this American Urological Association registry. The use of active surveillance across the country has gone up from barely a quarter to nearly 60%. Over the prior decade. This is pretty rapid progress in the right direction, but it's also not nearly enough. That means we're still over-treating 40% of the low-risk disease at the time of diagnosis without even a test period of surveillance. And there's an incredible amount of variation. This is this plot is basically showing individual urologists around the country. This is the individual urology practices along the X, individual urologist along the way, is the likelihood of getting active surveillance if you show up at this practice to this urologist's door with low-risk disease. So depending on which urology practice in the U.S. you go to, 250 practices around the country, likelihood of surveillance ranges from 0 to 80%. Depending on which urologist you happen to knock on the door, 0 to 100%. Okay. Now, this is not unique to urologists or active surveillance. This is the small area variations problem we see everywhere in healthcare, but it's a huge problem. Literally on Wednesday, I saw a patient who was told by his local urologist for his 2 cores of 3+3, he should go straight to surgery because he was 59%. Outrageous. And this is in the Bay Area, right? It's worse in smaller parts of the country. So we need to risk stratify. You're going to hear a lot about these parameters as the morning goes on. Grade in particular, and the way we're thinking about pathology these days, in some cases, we will augment this with genomic tests and with pathology AI. And ultimately, you're going to hear about risk groups. This is the NCCN risk classification. There's one from the AUA. It's gotten a little bit complex and a little bit cumbersome. The very low risk group has really gone away from the AUA, and hopefully it'll go away from the NCCN soon. We shouldn't even find these. This is honestly not a great way of doing it, but it's still the most common. The reason this risk stratification is not terrific is there's a lot of heterogeneity within those boxes. We have the CAPRA score here, which is now 20 years old, which uses the same variables, but it's a lot more accurate and precise in terms of stratifying them in terms of likelihood of the cancer actually causing the problem. And just to emphasize the point about variability within these boxes, these are two men you can look at a glance. They have very different tumors. The one on the left with a low PSA, low PSA density, that's the PSA related to the size of the prostate, low stage. There's a little bit of 3+4, but it's only a fused gland subtype. You'll hear about that more in a minute. Unfavorable intermediate because there's a lot of Gleason 3-3 here, 7 out of 12 cores. It's called unfavorable in a lot of radiation oncology hands. That means, extended hormonal therapy if you're going down the radiation path. The guy on the right, much more aggressive cancer, intraductal, higher grade, also unfavorable intermediate. They're in the same bucket. The CAPRA score will clearly separate them in terms of risk. And this is just what it looks like by CAPRA here. As you go to the right here, you want to stay at the top of the screen. This is the percentage of the men that are still alive and have not died of prostate cancer. Low risk disease, almost nobody dies. This is up to 16 years now. In the capture registry, higher risk disease, almost half of all men can die of the disease within 10 years. So, but that's the uncommon situation. Most of the cancers are in the low and intermediate range of things. And it's important to remember that even high risk prostate cancer, survival at 5 years is basically 100% when the disease is localized. And we have more medications for advanced disease than we know what to do with today. You're going to hear about that a lot as well in the afternoon. Treatments both for localized and advanced disease are improving every year. And many of the side effects can be managed. And these are all themes we're going to touch on throughout the rest of the day. You always have time to make a decision. This is a disease that moves typically over years and over decades. Don't rush into things and make treatment decisions that resonate with you, your family, and your priorities. So with that, we'll pass it on.
Next, as part of our basics of prostate cancer, it's my pleasure to introduce Cornelia Bing. Cornelia, this is your first year doing this, right? Second, oh, you did it last year, okay. No, you did it, that's right, you did it in our scientific retreat, right? So Cornelia is relatively new to our faculty, although she has been on at UCSF for some time for her training. Dr. Ding is a remarkable pathologist who has focused specifically on prostate cancer, and understanding prostate cancer is not subtle. It's not, it is subtle, it's not easy. We constantly learn from her. And one of the things we always hear about is, gee, how do I interpret my pathology report? And that's what she's going to clarify. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ding.
Many of us, including myself, sometimes get confused about pathology report. And to be very open, I actually got a phone call from clinicians, sometimes well-known, very smart, very established clinician call me, what is this about the report? So it's a confusing document and is. I understand the frustration and sorry, we are still on our way to make our pathology report better to be understandable for all the people, including most importantly, our patient. But I do want to highlight that because pathology report serve multiple functions. It's a very important piece of medical record. It needs to be very accurate. And also it's an important tool to communicate with other doctors, including other pathologists in other hospital. And if you transfer your care from one place to the other, different surgeons, they make their decision based on the report. So we have to put a lot of information there. And it's also a legal document. So it is important we document what actually happened to this patient, what tissue exactly be taken out and examined, what kind of tests we perform. So it's important for viewing and also important for be tracking if there's any legal issue need to be involved. So with that in mind, you can understand that there's a lot of terms and part of the pathology report not necessarily written in patient language. Sorry about that, but I think with my 10 minutes introduction today, I hope I can give you a structure how to look at the pathology report. So you have a big picture in your mind. And when it comes to details about certain disease features, and that will be a discussion in depth with your doctor. So in general, any pathology report, you can get a prostate, non-prostate, benign tumor. There's basically five components in any report. They can look very different from the surface, but this is basically five components you can see. First, most important thing is the patient information, you know, your name, your date of birth, what time of the tissue was taken out from your body. Those kind of things are essential because it's essential to not mixing up different specimens. And then I think most of us here hear about today is the diagnosis and the comment, what kind of cancer, what kind maybe not cancer, and what features in this cancer we are looking at. But also importantly, but probably not, we don't read it that often as a patient, is a gross description addendum. So gross description or specimen received are basically a section describing what tissue we received in pathology by my eyes. So for example, did my surgeon give me an intact piece of prostate, or did they give me fragments of prostate? Did they tell me they give me a gallbladder and what I actually received is debris? You know, so that, those kind of things, I have to make sure what I received on pathology matching the surgical document, like your op report. And finally, addendum. So sometimes after we sign out the case, and then we decided, oh, we want to send this test out for a molecular test, or we want to do a different ancillary test. So those didn't change the diagnosis, but we have to document our pathology material was sent out for those tests. Those are addendum. So this is an actual UCSF report for a prostate, localized prostate biopsy. And I have to say that UCSF actually issued probably the most sophisticated pathology report. A lot of time in other institutions, the same material might just get one page of report. And the reason is we put a lot of information and to help our clinician to make their treatment plan. And we actually take really proud of that. And if you can understand a UCSF pathology report, I think you're probably fine everywhere. So with that five component in your mind, you can see that on the top is always the patient information, and then we put diagnosis, and then we put comment regarding the tumor features in the comments, and then last the last two pages of the report, you can see the gross description, which we probably don't spend too much time on that, but that is likely to be in the document. So patient information, very important. And if you want to know who you want to blame for a very slow report, you can find their name there because we have to sign our signature at the end of the report. So, Dr. Ding, you're so slow on my report. Now you know. Okay. So how do you know if the report changed? So, you know, sometimes we get some typos. Sometimes I just lost my mind and to err is human, right? So if I found I have an error in my report, I have to amend it. I have to document when did I amend it, why did I correct it. So to avoid confusion, we typically, the electric medical record will hide the error report, and they will put a corrected report in the system so no one can confuse. But the wrong report is always in the document. And so if you are wondering whether your report was changed at some time by someone, and you check the top part of the report, say if it's amended, and the timestamp is the time I changed the report, and who changed the report will have the electric signature on that. And I have to put in the comment, like, what is the reason I changed the report? So, you know, like in this case, I probably typed the Gleason score wrong. So I say it is corrected to the correct score. And I notify the urologist, say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I document when and how I communicate with my urologist. Okay, so now the key part of the pathology report. What is the diagnosis? So you can typically think about any tumor diagnosis into three categories. Benign, you don't see any tumor. A typical, you see something suspicious. And cancer, right? So benign, we often specify what kind of tissue we see under microscope because, you know, by our bare eyes, they're just like a strip of tissue, but it can be prostate, it can be from seminal vesicle, it can be from lymph node. So that's important information for your surgeon to know where did they put their needle in. And if I say something atypical, in prostate, usually you see two language that's interchangeable. A lot of pathologists call atypical focus ASAP or atypical small acinar proliferation. And some of pathologists call these kind of focus called rare atypical glands. They are the same thing. So basically what that means is that there are small focus. There are some features suggestive of cancer, but not diagnostic. So it's suspicious, but we couldn't push more further to put our C-word on that small focus. And it often represents, if proved to be cancer, a low grade, the cancer that we don't want to find actually. So we put a flag there and say, well, there's something atypical. However, it's probably not high risk. And it's a conscious judgment. Like, you know, if this is in a patient with like PSA 200, you probably want to re-biopsy the patient. But, you know, if this is in a screening, and you probably can just follow up the patient with other clinical information. So ASAP, rare atypical glands are interchangeable terms for atypical category. And for cancer, most common prostate cancer is prostatic adenocarcinoma. So there are some other rare subtypes, including ductal carcinoma, small cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, basal cell carcinoma, et cetera. And sometimes, unfortunately, there's other cancer could spread into prostate, like melanoma, like bladder cancer, like urothelial carcinoma. So different flavor of cancer, but that's important because that impact treatment decision and management plan. So, okay. And then we often put a Gleason score on the top line, and there's a lot of numbers. They get very confusing. I often got phone call from patient or from patient's family, like, what is Gleason score? What is grade group? What is Gleason pattern? And they are all numbers. So I'll go to the detail in this a little bit. And there's also other related terms that even make this thing more confusing, like intraductal carcinoma and atypical intraductal proliferation. They both have ductal. What does that mean? And then there's also high grade. Oh, high grade sounds really high risk. High grade PIN. Like, did I have something really terrible? So let me go into detail of these terms. So Gleason score are developed by Dr. Gleason. Basically, he separated, it's actually a team, but including Dr. Gleason, separate tumor prostate cancer into five different pattern groups. And now we don't call anything one and two, so you practically only see Gleason pattern 3 and 4 and 5 in your report in a modern prostate biopsy. And basically, a score is a summary of two most prevalent patterns in the tumor. So if the most prevalent pattern is pattern 3, and the second most prevalent pattern is pattern 4, you get a score of 3 plus 4 equals 7. And this number is very confusing because 3 plus 4 equals 7 doesn't equal to 4 plus 3 equals 7. They are pretty different. So that's why later on people decided, well, maybe let's make things easier. Let's put it into grade group. So, you know, by different combination, you can basically get five different scores. You know, 3 plus 3 equals 6 versus 5 plus 5 equals 10. And we basically group that into five groups. So basically larger the number means more aggressively the tumor look under the microscope. Whether they are truly aggressive is actually a combination of pathology and also clinical information. So don't freak out just because you see a large number in your report. However, in general, the sense is that you can group different score into five groups, so it's easier to understand the prognosis. And just briefly, what are the difference of these three terms that you can see in your prostate biopsy report? So intraductal carcinoma, it's still controversial whether we grade them into Gleason grading. In UCSF, we grade them together with Gleason. However, intraductal carcinoma alone as a pattern is a high-risk pattern that is almost like a red flag. So if we put that in the report, the clinician know, even though the Gleason score looks low, like 3+4, this patient may need some more additional follow-up. So that's what it means. And a typical intraductal proliferation, or AIP, are lesions. You see the word atypical, so you know like what pathologists are thinking now. They are thinking things almost look like intraductal carcinoma IDCP. However, not yet. It's suspicious, but not diagnostic. So you basically put a flag there thinking, well, I'm worried this patient might have a high risk pattern, but I'm not that sure. So I put a flag there, so we keep follow up. And this is pretty much only applicable in biopsy. And finally, high-grade intraepithelial lesion. So the history of this is that this is considered a pre-cancer lesion. They have some feature overlap with cancer, but nowadays we know these almost have no clinical significance. If this is the only thing you have in your report, you can basically think you have a benign disease, unless your PSA is crazy or you have a crazy MRI. So in short, don't worry about high-grade PIN. Talk to your clinician if you have an AIP, and if you have an IDCP, you probably want a second opinion on other pathologists because it's a really high-risk pattern. Okay, so just briefly, we put a lot of information in our comment at UCSF, and if you there's one thing you really want to look at, I will recommend you to look at the section comment on Gleason pattern 4, because Gleason pattern 4, although they are four, there are actually multiple different patterns, and some of them are more aggressive than others. And one of the common aggressive pattern is actually large cribriform. So you want to show your doctor you're very smart reading your report, say, whoa, I see no large cribriform in my report. I'm probably okay, right? And then your doctor might tell you, well, but you have to consider your clinical presentation and other lab tests, etc. So, you know, make your conversation sound a little smarter. Look at this part. And other part include very detailed of like tumor volume in each core, whether they involve new nerve, whether they are involving extra prosthetic tissue, etc. So it's a lot of information, and you can take your time reading it. And there are also some language here you will feel like, well, how is this relevant to me? So these are basically comments I write for my coders when they see the document, they know what test I perform and how do they charge per report. So you don't have to put a lot of attention on those segments. Okay, so finally, I do want to touch a little bit on gross description. You want to make sure how many tissue core the clinician take away from you is diagnosed. So want to make sure the number match. For example, here that there are 8 part of prostate examined at pathology. So you want to make sure that number match. And finally, if your tissue block is sent out for a molecular test, we document it as a addendum. So it can be updated after the case is signed out. So you can check your electric medical record periodically to see if there's any more tests done by your clinician or by your request. So this is the pathology 101. Hopefully that's helpful, and happy to take any question. Thank you.
That was a perfect segue in that. Indeed, oftentimes we will add or you will hear about some sort of genetic testing that is done either on the specimen or that is requested of the patient. So to discuss that, my friend and colleague, Dr. Jonathan Chow, who is a medical oncologist, laboratory-based investigator, but also spectacular clinician, who's going to walk us through genetics and genomics, which should be in every center now, absolutely standard of care. John, thanks for being here.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Small. So I have 10 minutes to share something that I can probably take 2 days to talk about. My name is Jonathan. I'm a medical oncologist. I'm going to talk about the genetics and genomics of prostate cancer and really focus on the implications and sort of the practical aspects of current and future patient care. So I just want to take a brief detour back to high school biology, probably, for some of us, but to just recognize and to state out loud that prostate cancer cells, just like every other cells in our body, are made up of DNA, RNA, and proteins. And so these DNA,
see, this is not, okay.
So the DNA is made up of four different bases that we call A, T, G, and C. You can see the full names here in the left panel. And there are two key hallmarks that make prostate cancer or any cancer actually a cancer. And those are that the genetic instructions within those cells end up leading to either uncontrolled proliferation, meaning the cells are continuously dividing, or they lead to a decrease in apoptosis, which is another word for cell death. Okay. And so what do I mean when I talk about cancer genetics and genomics? It's really the understanding of the changes that occur within the DNA, the RNA, and the protein levels that make those proliferation and those changes in cell death. And in fact, we also know now that the DNA is wrapped up in these proteins called histones that can actually change how the message is actually read. Because if we have DNA that's really wound up in these histones, those messages can't be actually seen in the cell. So how can we use genetics and genomics in terms of prostate cancer care? So I'm gonna highlight three ways that I think about it when I meet a patient in clinic. And the first thing is identifying genes that might put a patient or his family at risk for developing prostate cancer. And so this is really thinking about the family tree and thinking about early detection and screening for other family members, as well as screening for the patient. So for patients who have a big family history where multiple brothers, grandfathers, fathers, uncles, et cetera, have prostate cancer, it really changes the way that I think about the patient. The second thing that Dr. Cooperberg talked a little bit about, he used a different analogy, the rabbits and the turtle, but I'll use separating the lions from the kittens. So thinking about people who have indolent disease versus those who have more aggressive disease biology, the tigers in the room. And the last thing is thinking about how do we use the information to actually tailor our treatments accordingly. So is there, in other words, an Achilles heel in those mutations that we can actually use to target? So in order to actually characterize prostate cancer, at UCSF, we've been looking at this for over the last decade. This is actually work that is led by Dr. Small and Dr. Fang, where we have biopsied patients, both tumor biopsy, tissue biopsies, as well as liquid biopsies. These are blood-based biopsies, to subject cells to a battery of different tests that I'm just showing you up here. So whole genome DNA sequencing, looking at the DNA, RNA sequencing, looking at the RNA, whole genome bisulfite sequencing, looking at how the DNA is structured differently, et cetera, et cetera. And these studies in the last 5 to 10 years have really set the field in a new direction of thinking about how do we actually treat and think about prostate cancer. So one of the things that we've discovered, for example, is that there are some mutations that are inherited from your parents. We call these germline mutations. And these are the mutations that may be transmitted to biological children and may also affect your treatment. So it wasn't until almost 10 years ago that we started to appreciate that about 12% of men, depending on different studies and different areas of the world that you look at, have a mutation in a DNA repair gene. And if you take a look at the pie chart of what those genes are, what we found very surprisingly was that a gene called BRCA2 was found in about 44% of men, okay? BRCA2 stands for breast cancer-associated gene. And so while we had understood that BRCA2 mutations conferred increased risk in women to developing breast cancer, it was underappreciated until the study that BRCA mutations can also affect cancer development in men. The other types of mutations that we think about are mutations that are acquired over the course of your lifetime. So remember that cells are constantly dividing as we age, and we're also being exposed to things that might cause mutations, such as radiation from the sun, et cetera. And so these are what we call somatic mutations. And importantly, these are mutations that cannot be transmitted to your own children, but they also may affect your own treatment. And what I'm listing and showing you here is just the fact that we've now discovered that there are so many different genes that all lead down to the same road of causing prostate cancer. And so I'm just putting a smattering of different genes here that are commonly found in patients that we've biopsied. And what you can see is that different patients essentially have different building blocks of making their cancer. And so what we are trying to do is to really understand these different genetic and genomic building blocks for each individual patient, and thinking about how these building blocks should affect the way that we treat the patient in front of us. So I'm giving you one example of that. So this is actually a study that was published by Dr. Feng almost 10 years ago now. And based on this genomic score that Dr. Feng and his team developed at the time, you can see that there were some patients who had a high score and some patients who had a low score. And what he wanted to ask is, which were the patients that actually benefited from radiation therapy? So if the two lines are overlapping, it means that there was no additional benefit to the treatment that was given. So you can see that patients on the right who have a low genomic score actually did not benefit from radiation treatment. So their cumulative incidence of developing cancer later on down the road in their lifetime was actually the same. Whereas patients who had this high genomic score really, really benefit, see that the red line really gets suppressed. And so these are really the patients that we might want to think about how we incorporate radiation into their treatment plan. Here's another example that was just recently published now, about 2 years ago now, for those BRCA patients who have mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2. And you can see that this is a treatment that is really targeting the Achilles heel of the cancer, these PARP inhibitors, which do benefit patients who have these BRCA1 and BRCA2 alterations. And finally, what I'll say is that the genetics within prostate cancer actually can alter the proteins that are on the cell surface. We know that these are great proteins that we can exploit for imaging and diagnostic and treatment purposes. And the one that Dr. Small initially mentioned earlier was PSMA targeting that we can use both as a PET scan, as a diagnostic modality, as well as now drugs. And so we are starting to discover that there are certain patients that their genetics actually tell us that they don't have very high PSMA expression. And so here what I'm showing you is immunohistochemistry that Dr. Dingen talked about. The stain for each protein is in brown. So you can see there's not a lot of brown in the middle for this particular patient, but there is a lot of brown staining for another target called DLL3. So discovering a new Achilles heel of surface targets for different patient subtypes that have expression of one protein, but perhaps not the other. And really it's the guide, this holy grail of oncology treatments of precision medicine, and that we know that there are patients right now, we group them all together, we just say that you have prostate cancer, but what we really know is that prostate cancer has all these different building blocks, all these different mutations that can confer and lead to a development of prostate cancer. And we're now starting to say, okay, well, patients who have a pink mutation, we should give them a pink pill, a blue mutation should get a blue pill, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just wanted to end and say that it really takes a team, hard work, dedication, and funding to advance prostate cancer research and patient care. And so this is a picture of my own group. So these are all college grads and recent minted PhDs. To show that we have a great group of people who are excited about advancing prostate cancer care. But it does take funding from the DoD that funds the CDMRP, the NCI, which is a sub-branch of the NIH. And for those of you who don't know, the Prostate Cancer Foundation also does a lot of funding. And certainly at all levels, from trainees that are new college grads, all the way up to our senior faculty. So with that, I'd like to thank you, and we'll take questions at the panel.
So we've got two more talks in this introduction. I'm going to do the next talk, which is entitled The ABCs of ADT. So ADT is androgen deprivation therapy. And hopefully this is review for many of you, but I find it never hurts to review it. So, and we do it at the beginning because it ends up being an important part of treatment, probably for every stage of prostate cancer, increasingly so. So prostate cancer cells, wherever they're found in the body, and I've put a white blob around it. Doesn't matter if they're in the prostate or in the lymph nodes or the bone or the tip of your nose, they're all prostate cancer cells, and they all behave well the same way. They depend on the male hormone testosterone to survive and grow. The male hormone testosterone is produced by two glands, or two sets of glands. The testicles provide 85% of the total testosterone pool. The adrenal glands, which normally are involved in balancing minerals and fluids in your body, on the side, they've got a moonlighting job. And their moonlighting job is to make a little bit of testosterone, 15% of the total pool. So as far as the testicular testosterone is produced, we know that it is stimulated by a sequence of hormones produced by two glands that are at the base of the brain, the hypothalamus and pituitary. And there's just a cascade of signals that gets to the testicle and says, guys, wake up, make testosterone. And it's that male hormone testosterone that really makes the prostate cancer grow. The yellow arrow from the testes is intentionally larger than the yellow arrow from the adrenal glands, because that's where the bulk of the testosterone is coming from. So in the 1940s and 50s, a man named Charles Huggins, who's a urologist at the University of Chicago, discovered that getting rid of testicular testosterone led to significant regression of prostate cancer. It was such an important observation, we still do it today. He won a Nobel Prize for that observation. It turns out that eliminating testosterone can be done in a number of different ways. The way Dr. Huggins did it was to surgically remove the testicles. But that was then, that's not now. We don't need to be doing that now. What we now need to do is simply use a drug that, where the pink X is, blocks the signal between hypothalamus and pituitary, prevents that signal from getting through, so the signal never gets to the testicles and the testicles stop producing testosterone. And this is very, very effective. Turns out there's a number of agents that do this. These are listed here. There's probably more generics along the way, but this is easily accomplished with any of these agents. While the efficacy of these agents is absolutely the same, there's no advantage of one over another. They all work equally well. They have slight differences, and there are different circumstances in which they might be used. I'm going to show these to you. So the first, Alex Gibbon, Leuprolide, the most common formulation is Lupron, but there are others, is an intramuscular shot in your tush, in your rear end. Goserelin or Zoladex is a subcutaneous pellet that's done under the skin. Degarelix is a shot that can be given subcutaneously. And Relugolix is a pill, which is the latest addition to the armamentarium. And we'll talk about pros and cons in a sec. How often? The beauty of Leuprolide is that it can be given as a one-month, three-month, four-month, or six-month injection. So it gives you lots of flexibility. It's a depot formulation, so it's not like you're getting extra more side effects. It just gets released over the longer time period. We tend to use three-month shots because that seems to sort of, on the one hand, it's not so often that it's burdensome. On the other hand, it allows us a little flexibility to stop and start as need be. But they really are all quite equivalent. We certainly have patients who prefer one-month shots just because they want to be seen once a month and are here, and that's fine. But every 3 months is fine as well. The Zoladex, the Goserelin, is either a 1 or 3 month injection. The Degarelix, unfortunately, is only available as a monthly injection. It's subcutaneous, and I'll show you some pros and cons of it. And the Relugolix is a pill. So the pros of that is that you don't have to get a shot. The cons of that is that you have to take a pill every day. So it just depends what your preference is. In terms of concurrent therapy, typically when we give a drug like Leuprolide or Goserelin, won't bore you with the details, but the first thing that we see is a little bump in testosterone. It's called a testosterone flare, and you have to protect against that so that cancer cells aren't stimulated. And that generally requires a month's worth of an oral medication like Casodex. By contrast, Degarelix and Relugolix do not cause that bump or flare, so you can completely avoid the Casodex. So six of one, half dozen of another. In terms of One of the observations that has been made is that the latter two, Degarelix and Reliodolix, Degarelix is sold as Firmagon, Reliodolix is sold as Orgovyx. There is a indirect sense that it will reduce coronary artery complications in patients with coronary artery disease. If you don't have coronary artery disease, it really has no impact on the likelihood of secondary coronary artery events. So in general, you know, certainly if that's an issue, we will be using one of these approaches. There's a sense that maybe one of these, Reliodolix or Degarelix, have less side effects than the other pills. I actually am not convinced of that. I don't think the data really supports that, because the side effects that you get from these medications are not from the medicines. It's from a low testosterone level. And they all drop testosterone level the exact same way. So that generally is not a reason to choose one over another. But certainly the coronary artery disease is a very important consideration. And then lastly, the Degarelix, the Firmagon. Has anyone in the audience gotten the Firmagon shot? A couple of people. For some people, it hurts like the Dickens. It just hurts a lot. Not everyone. It can cause a welt that goes under the skin, and it can be painful. So you just have to be aware of it. It goes away. It's not incapacitating pain, but we have to be very conscious of warning you ahead of time that, hey, listen, it's likely you're going to get a welt. It's likely that it might help hurt a little bit. But it's a very useful medicine when you want to start right away, because you don't have to get on the Casodex and so forth. Similarly, the Reliodolix, the Orgovyx are pills. So it's rapid onset and also rapid offset. So you can start and stop relatively quickly. The only issue with Orgovyx that I always warn people about is it's a pill, so there may be a significant copay for it, depending on your insurance. If you have Medicare, it's generally covered, but it is very expensive. And so it's just something to look at. Whenever we prescribe any medication at UCSF, we go through our specialty pharmacy that always does an insurance check first. So you're protected that way, but it's just worth being aware of. All right. So we've talked about the testicular testosterone. It turns out that the adrenal testosterone can also be blocked. And it can be blocked either by targeting the uptake of the cancer into the prostate cancer cells, and that's what that big pink bar means, that just prevents the drugs being absorbed into the prostate cancer. There's six on the market. The first three are sort of the first generation ones that work, but not as well. And the latter three, Xtandi, Erleada, and Nubeqa, are drugs that are the next generation, if you will, and are more effective. The other approach, the other approach is, instead of blocking the uptake of the testosterone into the prostate cancer cells, you just stop it being produced by the adrenal glands. And that's what a drug called abiraterone or Zytiga does. Abiraterone, by the way, and apalutamide were drugs developed at UCSF. Their early trials were done in our program. These drugs, as a class, so enzalutamide, apalutamide, darolutamide, and abiraterone, you will hear referenced as androgen signaling inhibitors, ASIs, or RCs, androgen receptor signaling inhibitors. So if you hear about an RC, it's one of these second agents that blocks them. There's pros and cons to all of these agents, depending on the setting in which they're used, and other medical conditions that will arise. I'm not going to talk about them in great detail, but they are all perfectly reasonable. At UCSF, on the medical oncology side, when we're going to use one of these, we tend to start with abiraterone and Zytiga, because if it stops working at some point in the future, you're going to be on it long term, then one of the secondary blockers has reasonable efficacy, 40 to 50% range. Whereas if you flip that and you start with one of the blockers, and then try to come back with abiraterone, it only works 3 or 4% of the time. So given a choice, it gives us a little bit in the way of extra options down the line. But by and large, I think it's very fair to say that these drugs are, for all intents and purposes, equivalent. So historically, what we used to do is we would, I guess the pointer on this doesn't work, is we would block the testicular production of testosterone, treatment number one. And when it stopped working, we'd move on to treatment number two, which is one of these blockers, one of the ASIs, RCs. But it was subsequently observed that instead of going treatment one followed by treatment two, and you'll be hearing more about this afternoon, that treatment one plus treatment two at the same time works better. And that treatment one plus treatment two, you will hear referenced as ADT, androgen deprivation therapy, intensification. I prefer to use the term augmentation because it's not that intense. But that doubling up, treatment one plus treatment two, has become the standard in many, not all, circumstances. And I'm going to show you a slide that shows you how we measure this. So compared to ADT alone, ADT intensification prolongs life in men with newly diagnosed metastatic disease and in selected patients who are going to get radiation therapy. So it has really become the standard, not just to use ADT, but to add to it. And that really should be almost always the default. In lower risk patients that are getting lower amounts of hormones with radiation, it's not necessary. So it's only in selected patients. So you've already seen a curve like this, but I wanted to, because you'll be seeing them throughout the day, I wanted to take 2 minutes, less, 1 minute, to describe to you what a Kaplan-Meier curve is. That's what this curve is called. The Kaplan-Meier curve is a way of describing events over time. That's all. And it's the probability of those events based on the data that you follow in patients. And so the way, I'll show you the details in just a second of what this curve shows, but the way these curves are set up is on the x-axis horizontally, it's just time from the start of your treatment. So from 0 months here out to 66 months. On the y-axis, on the vertical axis, is a percentage of patients who have had an event or haven't had an event. In this case, it tells you the percentage of patients who are alive. So you start at 100%. And over time, things happen and survival decreases. And I want to point out that oftentimes curves like this include, unless otherwise specified, survival for all causes. So if there's someone on this one of these curves who got hit by a bolt of lightning, he's represented. So it's not just prostate cancer. You can have prostate cancer specific survival curves, but then it wouldn't say overall survival on the left, it would say prostate cancer specific survival. And so if you look at the white line, what you see is that in patients who are treated with androgen deprivation therapy alone, plus a placebo, over time it declines. Usually going down, down, down. And the way we measure it, the standard measure, is you look, and Dr. Agarwal will talk about this a little bit more as well, but the measure that the FDA, that everyone is looking at for drug approval, is what is the proportion that at when you have 50% of patients who have experienced an event, whether the event is survival or metastasis or whatever, how long does it take you to get that 50% mark? And so here you can see that on the white line, if you dotted white line picks out 50%, you can see that it's 36 months, which gives you the quote unquote median event rate, median in this case, survival, overall survival. And so the way we look at efficacy of a drug is we say, well, now we're gonna do a randomized trial in which we take 1,000 patients and 500 of them get ADT and we give them a placebo, and 500 of them get ADT and they get AA's abiraterone. This is the original study that demonstrated the efficacy of abiraterone. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a placebo. It could be standard of care. So you get the standard of care, 36.5 months is the average survival, median survival. Whereas now the yellow curve shows you that the average survival is pushed out to 53 months. And so what we look for is a separation of the curves. The more the curves are separated, the more the impact. The less they're separated, the less of the impact. And the difference in that separation is generally referred by what's called the p-value, which just gives you the statistical significance of the separation. Dr. Agarwal will talk to you later about the hazard ratio and what that means. So this is the way you'll see Kaplan-Meier curves shown to you. Dr. Kruperwick showed you a curve. It was reversed. It was the curves were going up. I think it was for but it's exact same principle. It's likelihood of an event over time. That's how you interpret these. And you just want to be able to separate them. We were all taught, you know, you want to be able to drive a Mack truck between the two curves, not have a little mosquito flying through the two, because that's not significant. Okay. So in this particular study, back before abiraterone Zytiga was approved, and it's the first of the drugs to be approved, we asked the question, well, if we do treatment one plus treatment two together, the yellow line, versus treatment one followed by treatment two later, the white line, is there a difference? You can drive a Mack truck through. That's pretty healthy. Right? You've gone from a median survival of 36 to 53 months. FDA approved the drug on this basis. And I think most people would agree, yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, so now everyone knows how to read Kaplan-Meier curves for the rest of the day. So, androgen deprivation therapy synergizes radiation to improve outcomes in selected patients. You'll hear about that. It prolongs time to metastases in some men with a climbing PSA after local therapy. It reduces pain and improves quality of life. It prolongs life, I just showed you. And ADT intensification is a take home. You'll hear more about it. It's important in newly diagnosed metastatic disease. Now, if ADT is so wonderful, why don't we put it in the drinking water? Well, you'll hear later that besides the fact that it's not water soluble, it creates side effects. And there's a whole session on symptom management this afternoon where you'll be hearing about a lot of these. And we always have to be conscious about them. I'm not going to talk about them in detail now, except that as we use ADT, we're always thinking about this balance between benefits and side effects. So we can either reduce side effects for people who have less extensive disease, treatment de-intensification, or we maximize benefits in people who have higher or more extensive disease. And that's the principle of augmented or intensified ADT. I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. So the questions to be asking yourself always with ADT, is it needed at all? What's the best timing? What's the duration? And what's the intensity? And this is, as always, an important part of shared decision making. But these are fair questions to be asking your physician. Again, this afternoon, Dr. Rabel will be leading a session on symptom management of many of these side effects, so we won't touch base on it. But it is something very, very important that we don't just always give the treatment. We have to think of the calculus, which you can see. So Dr. Agarwal needs no introduction. We'll be talking about something that's really important, which is clinical trials and how we approach them, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions.
Today, it's really more focused on standard of care, what's the state of art, and we're not going to delve too much into the research we do here in prostate cancer, which is extensive, but I thought it'd be good to have at least one talk on clinical trials, because that's what I do a lot of. We get a lot of questions from patients, and I think it could be helpful just to kind of inform the overall agenda for today. So, you know, one of the things we mentioned already that's critical, you know, UCSF, I'm proud to be part of a program that's really been, you know, critical to the development of many important treatments and diagnostic agents in prostate cancer. And this is not hyperbole. You know, UCSF's been at the forefront with syphilis LT or Provenge, abiraterone, Eric mentioned that, apalutamide with both diagnostic PSMA PET imaging as well as the radioligands like Pluvicto, and more to come. And so the research we funding we get from the federal agencies as well as from PCF and other philanthropy is super important to us to be able to continue to advance this mission. As John mentioned, increasingly our clinical trials are not one size fits all, and that's appropriate. And increasingly it's the genetics and genomics. What is an individual patient's genotype in the tumor and what DNA do they inherit from their parents? And those things really inform truly what trials I'm considering for a patient in front of me. In our molecular oncology program, we might have 10 different clinical trials, all with very specific subsets across patients with different types of cancers, whether it be prostate or breast or lung cancer. We know that those cancers might behave similarly and respond similarly to certain targeted therapies. And that's really the way we think about enrollment in 2025. BRCA2 and the PARP inhibitor is obviously not a new thing, but that's a great example of a clinical trials and development of a medicine in specific groups of patients to really maximize the benefit for those patients. Phases of clinical trials, I think a lot of patients ask me, well, what phase of a trial am I joining? Really, the phases refer to the drug and where the drug is in development. And so we have classically phase one, you're learning about the drug, what are the side effects, what's the right dose to use. Phase two is what we call proof of concept. Is there enough activity? Is the PSA going down? Are tumors shrinking on a scan? Is the drug tolerated well? Is it metabolized well enough for us to really make that what we call go, no go decision? Say, we're going to launch a multiple year, very expensive phase three study, which is your classic, let's compare a new drug alone or in combination with whatever is the standard of care. That's difficult sometimes in the context of a rapidly changing treatment landscape to know what's the right comparator, but we do our best. And we get a lot of guidance from IRB, from the FDA to really design these studies in the right way. I will say that this classic paradigm is changing. Increasingly, we go straight from phase one to phase three, and phase one studies can now be 200, 300 patients big when a drug shows a lot of promise. There's a lot of excitement. We want to enroll patients. We want to treat them. We want to give the best therapies possible. And so we're part of phase one studies that can be very large, but for good reason when we're seeing really promising activity. So what are a couple of myths? One I hear a lot about placebo. I don't want to be on a placebo. It turns out that very few oncology trials actually are straight placebo where you're going to be flip of the coin. Either you get the drug or you get a placebo. There's actually very few trials that fall in that category. If there's a placebo involved, which is less than 10% of the time, usually it's an additive approach. There's a standard of care, and then we're going to test whether our drug adds to that standard of care versus placebo plus standard of care. Very rare to have a trial that's just straight drug versus placebo. Vast majority of the trials that we open at UCSF aren't even in that category, and patients go on. Most of the time, they're getting the drug. Of course, we don't know how well it's going to work, but that's what we're learning as we go. We definitely consider trials at every stage of the disease. You know, when I'm seeing patients in clinic, I look at all the options that are available to me, the standard of care, as well as the clinical trial options. And let's decide together, what's the best option at this stage? When we go through all the standard of care and then consider a trial, I think that we're really compromising what could be the best outcomes for the patients. And there's good data to support that. Patients that go on clinical trials generally have better outcomes. You know, there's, of course, many factors that go into that, but clearly it's important to consider these at all stages of the disease. We'll talk about the hazard ratio thing that Eric mentioned, and I hear a lot from patients, well, drug X is only going to give me 3 months median improvement. You hear that a lot when you see articles in New York Times and lay media, this is how studies are reported. But that's a population statistic. That's giving you an average for the study as a whole. Of course, you're an individual patient. And the point estimate of the median improvement can really grossly under or overestimate the benefit of the drug. So really, it's important to look at the hazard ratio, which the simple way is, as Eric said, can you drive a Mack truck through those curves? The larger the space and separation, the greater the hazard ratio is going to be. And to put it in the lay terms, let's say I have a hazard ratio of 0.6. Drug is effective. If you take 1 minus that number, 0.4, that means there's a 40% improvement in our drug versus standard of care with whatever the primary outcome is, whether it be overall survival, progression-free survival. So I really encourage you, you know, to be an informed consumer of scientific data, clinical trial data, whether it be in oncology or in any field, really focus on the hazard ratio. That's certainly what the FDA does when they approve or disapprove drug application. Other questions out of here, I think we covered this one. No, we definitely want to consider trials at all stages and really think about all the list of options that are available. Costs of a trial are not trivial, and we really try our best to maximize the amount of financial support we get from company sponsors. And I think there's more and more of a push to try to cover many of those items. We try to do insurance authorization and really make sure we're only billing patients for what we would consider to be the standard of care. Really trying to push sponsors to say, hey, even though a drug's standard of care for the setting, really think it's important that you provide it for patients. So we're really advocating. We have a lot of kind of high level agreements with a lot of pharmaceutical sponsors, but there's certainly still more work to be done there. Making our patient population in trials representative of the patients we see in California. We have a 25 county catchment area that spans a huge swath of California, way up north to the Central Valley, to many rural areas. And how can we expand our reach and really make sure our patient enrolled on our trials are representative? Want to call out Trial Library. This was a company that was founded by one of our medical oncologists here at UCSF, Hella Borno, that really is trying to get increased access to trials for patients that otherwise may not be seen at places like UCSF. Clinical trial matching tool, we're really proud to have rolled this out a couple of years ago as a really way to be comprehensive and really allow providers and patients to really search on a more granular level what trials are patients potentially eligible for. And the last thing I'll mention is just our affiliate partner sites throughout the broader Bay Area. This is something we're really actively focused on in the East Bay, South Bay Peninsula, North Bay, increasingly getting trials out to patients rather than making everyone come here to San Francisco, recognizing the challenges of traffic and parking and so forth. What do we decide to open here at UCSF? It really comes down to patient impact. What do we think of the drugs that are the most likely to benefit patients? What responds to the needs of our catchment area? What's innovative? Is this study design something that we can really buy into? And can we enroll patients? It does no good to open studies that we just don't have the patient population for. I will say one thing, that not all clinical trials are those that pharmaceutical companies want to sponsor. And this is where the federal funding piece and other foundational support makes such a difference. You know, novel combinations where you're taking agents that might be owned by different companies. Deintensification of treatment, giving less treatment and achieving the same level of outcome, something that, of course, pharmaceutical companies may not be as incentivized. Really focusing on the subgroups that are most likely to benefit. Again, you're shrinking the pie potentially, but you're maximizing the benefit of patient benefit for those patients. Those trials are critical for us to really advance the field.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.